let's take some questions. Over there, yes.
This question is for Kevin Kelly. Does technology want to self-excel the way Ray Kurzweil says it will?
I think so. I think that's what it seems to be doing. I mean, Moore's Law is really curious because it seems to be what technology wants, whatever we want, no matter how far we work on it. If, as these guys are suggesting, there actually is a double exponential over time, then that would suggest that technology wants to self-accelerate. So I think that's one of the things that technology wants.
Artificial intelligence is operating at a lower level of intelligence than natural intelligence, and therefore is considered dangerous. Would you agree?
Well, one of the problems in all this is we haven't addressed the cosmological perspective, is that we're here because we're here, and there could be a lot of worlds where there is no life. And therefore, making assumptions, you know, that throws question into a lot of these things. I tried to talk about this from the standpoint of co-extinction, which is if this had happened, we wouldn't be here to observe it, which is basically the cosmological argument. So the fact that it hasn't happened here doesn't mean it can't happen, and therefore we should be cautious. Now, some people reject these arguments out of hand, but I don't see any reason, you know, to reject these arguments out of hand. It gives me caution, and especially the newer work, which suggests that life may be rarer than we thought, the book Rare Earth and some of these things, make me have more caution. So everything, I mean, warning, every time I look, the farther I look, the more warning flags go up, quite frankly, for me. And I'm still looking.
Is it possible for intelligence to evolve while ethics and morals do not?
Well, I want to just point out that that in evolution, there's no ethics or morality until you reach complex societies. And in some sense, human societies, there may be some kind of small amount of ethics or morality in primates. Maybe even, you might say, within family groups in smaller, you know, bears and so forth. But effectively, I mean, it's tooth and claw, dog eat dog, and so forth. So up until you have human intelligence, I mean, microbes do not have morality and ethics.
Actually, Aristotle considered this question and said that it was basically rationality. Once you have rationality, the rational mind, you know, becomes, you know, to seek ethics.
Yeah, it takes a minimum level of intelligence to have anything remotely like that, it seems.
If you have rational mind, won't you get ethics and morality?
If you have intelligence, won't you then get ethics and morality? Does anyone want to comment on that?
I disagree with sort of the whole premises underlying this. I basically think that ethics is self-interest, but at a larger scale, and altruism is self-interest at a larger scale. The reason rationality gets you there faster is because it can see the outcome of various actions and not do the stupid thing right away. In fact, I think the equivalent of what you'd call ethical behavior evolves in stupid animals. The parasite-prey relationships, which start out very virulent and then gradually evolve into something less virulent because it's better for the parasite too, and then eventually, in some cases, evolve to a symbiosis, are basically an unintelligent system doing something that intelligence can maybe do in one step because it can foresee the consequences of acting, sort of being mean unnecessarily.
Real quickly, I mean, I talked about how the Greeks and romanticizing, I think we're reading ethics into the world if we assume things that look like ethical behavior, they're only because of Darwinism. And I think if we go back to, like I said, Aristotle, the rational mind that chooses to do something maybe against its own self-interest because they feel it's ethical, is it of different nature than the sort of Darwinian survival of the fittest that you were talking about? I think there's really a distinction.
Way back with the white hat in the back row.
There's a lot of effort going into defining and developing artificial intelligence. Is there any comparable effort in defining artificial wisdom?
Does anybody want to take that on? Ray?
Well, I don't think we'll see non-biological systems emulating anything we would call wisdom until they are of the complexity and depth and richness of human intelligence. Wisdom, the ability to respond appropriately to emotion, to understand the contradictory and ambiguous aspects of human emotion, are not side effects of human intelligence. That is the cutting edge of human intelligence. That is the most sophisticated, complex, difficult thing that we do. And our machines today are still a million times simpler than humans, and so they don't exhibit these endearing qualities. But it's the argument in my book that not only the MIPS, but the complexity and the richness and sophistication of these non-biological entities will exhibit these kinds of understandings, and we'll be able to use terms like wisdom and emotion appropriately for such systems. And in some cases, these systems will be derivative of human intelligence, a combination of created by humans, created by machines that were created by humans, created through biologically inspired models, copies of the human brain, some combination thereof, therefore derivative of the human civilization.
I'd like to give... I feel bad about this. The other room is not being represented. I do have one written question from the other room, and if we get some more written questions from the other room, so I'll be glad to read them aloud. It says here, anonymous question, what about the machine that has developed consciousness and wants to protect itself? Now, I can't interpret the meaning of this question, but Hans can.
I think self-preservation is not a natural. I think self-preservation is not a natural for anything. I think it's a particular behavior that's built into things likes and dislikes. It's perfectly easy to make a super intelligent machine whose primary goal is to jump off a cliff, and something based on a theorem prover. You know, it depends on the axioms, what theorems it can come up with. So I don't think becoming intelligent will automatically make it want to preserve itself. I think some machines will be built to want to preserve themselves under certain circumstances because it makes economic sense to do that. So these home robots I fantasize about will certainly want to protect themselves from random accidents, and they won't want to jump off cliffs and so on. But on the other hand, there's no reason, and this is of course sounding very much like Asimov's laws, why they wouldn't want to sacrifice themselves if there was some danger to their owner, or even if their job were in jeopardy, and sacrifice themselves was the only thing to do. Those machines, in fact, would do well in the marketplace, because if there's a machine that gives its life for you, you'd probably recommend that model to your neighbors, and they would buy more of them, and the factory that makes them would do really, really well. And in fact, there's a biological model for this that's quite good. Worker ants are very self-sacrificing, and that's because their success in the world depends on their nest doing well, so they're willing to die if the odds are. Of course, they don't rationally work this out. It's just the way they're wired, you know, because that's what worked in the past. But they'll die. A queen will sting. A bee will sting you and die, and yet it's good for the hive, and bees like it.
I think there's an important point lost here. Once you have self-replication, and if it's at all imperfect, you'll have variation. And once you have variation that has the slightest difference in the survival rate of the entity, and in this case we're talking about an entity that may have interests adverse to its human long-time earlier creators, then natural selection comes in automatically. It's not programmed in the sky. It just happens. And hence, once you have self-replication, you will have adverse to human interest created without any specific effort.
Is this self-replication involve the broadcast architecture? Or does it involve some other specific architecture?
Well, I wasn't talking about architecture. I was just giving you the four preconditions for Darwinian evolution to kick in. And it kicks in automatically, not because it was programmed at the meta level. It just, that's what happens when you have self-replication, variation, and structural differences that affect survival rates.
I think that this is a perfect illustration of the point I was trying to make, which is that when we think about self-replication, we think about the basically biological model. There are other very different models of self-replication. We need to explore those. Some of those models are inherently safe, and I think those are the models we need to pursue for commercial purposes.
I'll take a question here in black with the CMS. CM5, sorry.
How will we recognize a superior intelligence? For example, do cows recognize that we are intelligent?
Well, they probably wouldn't tell us, and there are probably many different possible answers to this question. It has to do with what is the definition of intelligence. Many people say it's the ability to communicate very complicated concepts through some kind of language. If they're better at that than we are, maybe that's a measure. To us, it would be how big are their radio telescopes? To a biologist, it might be what is the relation between the brain size and the body size of the creature. And those are just some ideas, and I think any of these might be sufficient, but I think it's a question which will only be answered when we really encounter other creatures and see what the situation is with them and what judgment we can make.
Well, I was discussing with a friend of mine what's called the Fermi paradox, which is if life is out there, why isn't it here? Because with von Neumann probes, you could roughly colonize a galaxy in 20 or 30 million years. And he pointed out to me that maybe they are already here. They're just simply implemented with femto technology, and we can't see them.
I'll just give a different perspective, which is if we can recreate human-level intelligence and combine that with some natural superiorities that machines already have, that's a very formidable combination. If I spend years learning French, I can't download that knowledge to you. We spent years training one research computer to understand human speech, and we actually use these self-organizing methods of neural nets and train it slowly and expose it to thousands of hours of speech and patiently correct its mistakes like we would with a child. But if you want your PC to understand human speech, you don't have to go through that several-year process. You can just download the resultant pattern. Our knowledge exists as a pattern of neurotransmitter concentrations, interconnections, and other aspects of our neural design. We can't copy and download those structures from one brain to another. Our brains also are very slow. I mean, it's remarkable that this electrochemical information processing, which is not digital, evolved, but it's extremely slow. That the slide you saw earlier, the reset time, means it's something like 200 calculations per second. Electronic circuitry is already 10 million times faster. So if we combine the natural advantages of machines, the pocket calculator, for example, with the sophistication and subtlety of human intelligence, that's a formidable combination.
Okay, I'll take one more question here. It says, I think an important question is being ignored between relinquishing or, what is this word, something or other, is regulating. Anyway, well, something like that. With that, who do we give the power to regulate the machines? Okay, some.
Yeah. Well, you know, the physicists who discovered fission, some of them afterwards said, gee, we wish the physical constant had been a little different. We wish it just had never existed. And I think we would have been better off. So for some of these technologies, we can hope they won't work. That would be the most helpful thing. But unfortunately, some of them are very dangerous. If we could develop more of an ethical world, we could probably successfully not do some of these. Some of these things involve large scale efforts, and if nobody spends the billions of dollars to make a huge advance, the field which we judge to be extremely dangerous might never exist. The people at Los Alamos pushed and made a bomb because they concentrated an enormous number of people. So we have a range of possibilities. We have scientists deciding not to do things because they take it on themselves, like Hans Bethe. We have stricter liability laws, so companies decide not to do it because they can't afford the insurance. We have internationalization of certain technologies which are judged to be commercially successful, but which are too dangerous to be widespread because of the danger to fall into the hands of extremists. And then we have ones which are so dangerous, like bioweapons, that we make every attempt to not participate in the creation of offensive bioweapons, as the U.S. has not since 1972.
John. I just wanted to repeat a piece of history. Many people have, several of us have referred to the time of the Manhattan Project and Vision and so on. The important thing that happened then was not only was there a government regulatory body, the Atomic Energy Commission, but there was the Union of Atomic Scientists. There were a whole bunch of bodies that interacted, sometimes cooperatively and sometimes combatively. But that's really the nature of the beast here. And I think if I were to follow what Bill's saying, that we want to, the point was that people were concerned. And that concern came because of knowledge. It seems to me important that we try to understand these things in the hopes that there will be concerned people. It's when we don't understand that we get into the real dangers.
Just one moment, Bill. I just want to read something here, which is very pertinent. It says, will this symposium be available for purchase on videotape? Will it be broadcast on the web? When, where, in what forums will this discussion continue? The answer to the videotape question is yes, it is, of course, it is being videotaped. It will be available through Stanford's Channel 51 for, I believe, $26. Probably it'll take a couple of weeks or something like that. But Channel 51 at Stanford will be able to supply videotapes. Will it be broadcast on the web? I believe so, through Dr. Dobbs' computer journal. And that may take, a couple of weeks. I couldn't tell you, but you probably can look it up on their website. As to where this discussion will continue, of course, that's not up to me. That's anybody's guess.
I have a letter here dated February 18, 1947. It says, through the release of atomic energy, our generation has brought into the world the most revolutionary force since prehistoric man's discovery of fire. This basic power cannot be fitted into outmoded concepts of narrow nationalism. There is no secret and there is no defense. There is no possibility of control except through the argued understanding and insistence of the peoples of the world. We scientists recognize our inescapable responsibility to carry to our fellow citizens an understanding of the simple facts of atomic energy and its implications for society. And this lies our only security and our only hope. We believe that an informed citizenry will act for life and not for death. We need $1 million. Please help. Faithfully yours, Albert Einstein.
There are some questions here. In the white.
Given that humanity is the parent of technology and Earth is the mother, is technology going to develop an Oedipus complex?
Does anybody have any comment on that? If not, we will all agree to smile. Larry Greed.
How do you distinguish intelligent machines from spiritual machines? I also have a question for Hans Moravec. In your personal system of ethics, is it possible for a robotic species to have greater ethical values than humans?
I'm just going to read a little bit from an interview with Hans, which I thought was fascinating. The interviewer says, you seem quite comfortable with your prediction that robots will displace humans from essential roles and eventually that they could displace us from existence. Aren't we talking about the end of the world here? If the world goes on and nobody is here to see it, won't we have failed as a race? question. Hans says, he may just want to say this is what I said and agree with himself, but I think it's a fascinating answer. He says, failed as a race implies some external criterion for success. Who knew there was going to be a test? Actually, I don't even consider the majority of organisms that became extinct without leaving any offspring to have failed as species. They also serve who only live and die, and thus map out the unviable portions of the evolutionary landscape and provide a background for the evolution of others. I think the evolution of life is the most interesting thing around and want to see it continue with utmost vigor. Producing artificial offspring that transcend us to the max is the most exalted role I can imagine the human race playing and would be the grandest success possible. On the other hand, if we chose to stagnate, indefinitely circumscribed by our present limitations, then by my standards we would be tragic failures, having turned our back on our potential.
Yeah, well, what can I add? yeah, I've forgotten the question, actually.
Ethical.
Oh, ethical, yeah. I think I really do think that that ethical is not, it's been elevated. It's somehow been made into this Platonic thing, which I don't think it is. I think it's an evolution. It's a kind of behavior that arose in us primarily because we live in societies, and some of the instincts we have for personal preservation, in fact, hurt the groups that we're part of, and so we're taught to not behave that way because. First of all, it'll be bad for us in the long run, but at very least it's going to piss off a lot of other people. And then they'll probably not cooperate with us and so on. And we've initially used those kinds of behaviors primarily in the context of tribal villages of a couple of hundred people. And with the advent of civilization, we've had to become very conscious of what we were doing. We could go by instinct in the tribal village, but when we lived in societies of thousands of people and now millions, the instincts are just not adequate anymore. So there has to be a set of taught rules. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the Code of Hammurabi and the Ten Commandments, you know, all appeared about 10,000 years ago at the beginning of us living in much larger communities than our instincts were tuned for. So I think something like that makes sense in a larger scale when we have super intelligences and lots more of them and greater variety, but we'll have to work out what the rules are then.
I do think that what we're talking about is the next step in evolution. I think as we go to 2030, 2040, when you meet a biological human, there will be some non-biological processes going on in their brain. That's already true of some humans today, Parkinson's patients with that implant, and I have a deaf friend who's profoundly deaf, has a cochlear implant, and so on. These are early primitive steps. But 30, 40 years from now, it'll be typical when you meet a biological human, there'll be some non-biological thinking processes going on in their brains. If you look at those charts earlier, biological thinking is flat maxed out at 10 to the 26th calculations per second for the human race, biologically speaking. The non-biological portion of our thinking is growing exponentially. By the end of the century, it'll be far more powerful than the biological part. That is, in my view, the next step in evolution. But I don't view that as not human. I don't see that as a successor. I don't think there's going to be a clear distinction between human and non-human intelligence. We're not going to say, okay, humans on the left side of the room, machines on the right side of the room. There's not going to be a clear distinction. We're going to have biological humans who have very powerful non-biological processes going on in their brains and bodies. We're going to have non-biological entities that are derived from human intelligence in a whole variety of ways, which will have human characteristics. On the issue of spiritual, what my book literally says is that we will meet entities. I use spiritual primarily to mean conscious, because I think that is the essence of spiritual value, to really have feelings and be aware of them. We will meet entities that appear to be conscious, and most humans will be so convinced by their behavior and the subtlety and richness and their emotional reactions that they will believe that they're conscious. And these machines will get mad at us if we don't believe them. But that's not a rigorous philosophical or scientific proof that these entities are conscious. And there'll be philosophers who say, well, no, they don't squirt neurotransmitters, so they can't be conscious. And they're not based on DNA-guided protein synthesis, and you can't be conscious unless you are. And fundamentally, there is no objective test to subjective experience. It comes down to the nature of those concepts.
Artificial intelligence, spirituality in several traditions involves a involves a physical practice, and I wonder how artificial intelligences and spiritual artificial intelligence would exist, or can spirituality exist only in the mind, not in the body, and how would an artificial intelligence or a spiritual artificial intelligence relate to the idea of the body, and how does the body figure into all of this?
Well, they'll go to their virtual house of worship of their choice.
I think that's a very serious question, the question about bodies. I may maybe try to expand on it a little bit, because it becomes such a dominant theme towards the end of both Hans's and Ray's books, namely the idea, in some sense, of people uploading their brains into some kind of medium in which those intelligences can interact more intimately than they can through, let's say, just ordinary language, and in which personalities, individuals start to blur more and more, because in essence, because of the lack of the constraints of bodies, also the lack of mortal bodies, and so the question is, what is intelligence, if it's going to happen, going to be like? What is existence going to be like, consciousness, awareness, when individual boundaries start to cease to exist and then perhaps completely cease to exist, and when mortality ceases to exist? All of which are very far-fetched ideas, being that they are very central ideas in these books, I'd like to hear some. Yeah, sure. Okay.
So to preserve my time at the beginning, I didn't use my slide to respond to your question, so now's my chance. I don't think that we're the native life form in the cyberspace. We were evolved in a world of up, down, left, right, day, night, father, family, son, child. We live in a different space, and the space in which the robots live, the cyberspace, isn't three-dimensional. It doesn't have evolution. It doesn't have all the things that we evolve with. And I think it's going to be a very lonely place for us in the end. If you put a human in a sensory deprivation tank, they go crazy. I think it's not going to be a human existence in there. Humans are not going to be the native life form. It'll evolve into something else, or something else will happen very quickly. And I think we're naive to not notice this fact about our biological existence.
It's not, I think virtual reality, which I think will be a place to be and meet other people, will end up being a superset of real reality. We will, our bodies are very important to us. Most of our, in my chapter on bodies, I talk about how most of our thinking is directed towards our body, protecting it, feeding it, nurturing it, providing for its myriad needs and desires and wants. But there's no reason why we will have bodies. In virtual reality, we will have left, right, up, and down. There'll be virtual environments which may not have these things, and which may have different properties. But we'll have a myriad of very lifelike virtual reality environments, so we can take a walk together on a virtual Cancun beach, or have this meeting in a virtual Mozambique game preserve, or a building like this and have the lights go out. But at the end of my book, my fictional character Molly says I can have a body anytime I want. And that's true in virtual reality, and also in the morphing qualities of real reality, which will be feasible through things like self-organizing nanobot swarms, which can create the kind of morphing qualities we associate with virtual reality and real reality.
Except that I agree with all that, but I think the larger world, the world beyond Earth, and the world of more subtle encodings, where there's lots more room than there is at, with the sort of large energy per bit that we're currently implemented in, will be different. We can recreate any reality, but in fact, I think the evolution of our descendants will in fact push them into new realms, and they'll become entirely different things than we are now. And I think that's an interesting and good thing. And I don't see why you're disturbed about that.
There was an eager person up there. Yes, eager person.
The panel is making the assumption that spirituality exists as a result of the material world. But isn't spirituality derived from a non-material world?
As I said earlier, I didn't want to invite to my panel people who I knew would reject out of hand the idea that consciousness or feelings or such things would in principle be impossible for other substrates such as a silicon substrate. I wanted to assume that it's a function of pattern and not of material. That may not be bought into by the audience, but that's what I wanted my panel basically to be composed of. That's a very interesting question, though. Many people have different opinions on it.
Stephen Gould wrote a book trying to argue for separate magisteria to separate the spiritual from the scientific. But unfortunately, there are already scientists who do not admit that boundary. Like E.O. Wilson wrote a book in 1978, I can't remember the title right now, won a Pulitzer Prize. And if you read chapter one of his book, he basically says, well, just do a natural history of the brain, figure out why we believe what we believe, and then decide what we want, thereby extending the domain of science to include all the spiritual. So that line is, if that was considered a bright line, it's been stepped over at least once. I would argue he's probably stepped back at this point, but I suspect other people will walk up and want to step over that line as well. And I think the people who have a traditional view of spirituality will find that very disturbing. They just haven't been told yet.
Yes, Ray?
I'll make a quick comment on that. But in my view, what's supremely spiritual is our pattern, and the pattern of a human being is immensely complex and rich and deep, and for me has spiritual value. And if I think about what I am, am I this stuff that's comprised of my body and brain? Well, these particles are changed over within a matter of months. I'm not the same particles at all that I was months ago. I mean, on a cellular level, you can talk about it in a matter of years. On a matter of particles, its turnover is much more rapid. We're really much more like the pattern of patterns that water makes, the ripples in a stream. The actual water molecules pass through in milliseconds, but that pattern can remain stable and maybe change gradually over hours and days and months. But that pattern is something that represents our essential essence, and that's something that we will gain greater understanding of as we go through the century.
In fact, I struggle with that in the last chapter of my book. Basically, because of debates, including some of the people supporting Searle, and the conclusion I was led to was that, in fact, it's not even just a pattern, but it's an interpretation of the pattern is what we really are. And it's actually possible to look at a person, if you were smart enough and could model them in sufficient detail, as a mechanical device. With input-output behavior entirely determined, you know, by the pattern of connections, basically like a wind-up toy. And a super-intelligent alien coming down may look at us in that way most naturally, not having the interpretation that we generally use for this is a belief and this is a feeling and this is a model of ourselves. I think with the robots, though, they'll naturally get that interpretation, because that's how we will begin to look at them. And within that interpretation, in which there are beliefs and feelings, the robots will believe they themselves have beliefs and feelings. So it may be a chimera. It doesn't have much to do with the material reality. The material reality is just a substrate,
where an observer interprets the existence of these patterns. But in fact, these patterns can be mapped, and it should be possible to find consciousness in anything. This is one of the Searle lines, the blackboard doing WordStar, or Putnam, the intelligence in the rock, because there is a mapping of the particles in the rock, say their thermal motions, which it's a complex mapping, but it maps them into a program that's an artificial intelligence program in which they have feelings and beliefs. And anybody can look at the rock, if they were smart enough, and make that mapping just in their heads and see feelings and beliefs in the rock. So that means that actually all possible worlds exist and all kinds of strange consequences, which I think are not inconsistent with physical reality as we know it, but which have the consequence that, in fact, physical reality itself is just a way of looking at things. And the things that are doing the looking are entities that, of course, exist in the physical reality, at least in one way of looking at it. Basically, we don't really exist. We only think we do.
There's one question here I'm going to read. It says, John Holland said we can't expect machine intelligence in the near future, even using evolutionary methods, because we don't have the theoretical basis. Doesn't the fact that intelligence evolved naturally contradict the need for theory?
There's a little matter of time involved.
I think that was pretty much the answer I anticipated. Yes.
Species displace or replace other species in extinction, so evolution may be much more merciless than Kevin Kelly suggested.
What I say was replace, not kill off or cause extinction. Yes, obviously. There are many, many examples of extinctions, and a lot of them even in terms of deliberate extinctions brought about humans. What I was talking about was replacement. When the humans killed off the megafauna, they weren't displacing them, replacing them. They weren't trying to be mastodons and mammoths. And so what I was talking about was the phenomena where you have a species replace an existing species and substitute for it. That doesn't happen very often.
The actual truth is, I think, that in an ecosystem, if one species disappears, there's a niche left which another species often evolves very quickly to fill. So it's a very natural process.
Bill?
If all human intelligence were to be implanted into a computational system, wouldn't that constitute God?
I'm not quite sure where God came into the picture, but it was a question of many, many intelligences simultaneously cohabiting in the same hardware, something like that.
Well, there's some practical considerations in your proposal. But as the sort of substrates with which we can represent intelligence grow more powerful, in this century and beyond this next century, we will be able to have multiple intelligences cohabiting. We have multiple intelligent processes in our brains right now. I don't think it follows if you were to capture millions, billions of human brains in one substrate that you have God. I don't know that all of humanity represents God. All of humanity represents one enormous potential, but God is presumably infinite. I guess I would. What this inspires in me is the following sort of connection of this discussion to spirituality, which is, in my mind, evolution is a spiritual process because it's growing exponentially more capable and more powerful. If we just look at biological evolution, entities become more beautiful, they become more intelligent over time, more sophisticated, more complicated. And what have we called God? God is all-knowing. God is infinite intelligence, infinite beauty, infinite creativity. And evolution creates entities that become exponentially greater in those qualities, but never really reaching infinite capability. So evolution moves towards our concept of this ideal of God, which is to say in a spiritual direction, but never really achieving
the ideal of God. But, however, Hans and my formulas differ on this point.
I don't really even know what to say in that direction.
But before we're all inside the same computer matrix, of course, we may all be tied together through the internet, and I think you can see that empowers us somewhat, but we're not going to become omnipotent because of that.
I think that we're going to take 5 extra minutes. 5 minutes. It's 5:30 now. I will take 5 minutes because we started a little bit late. Orange shirt.
I have a question about the distribution of these technologies. Don't you think the affluent will benefit from these new developments, while the non-affluent will not?
Well, I think today we have a model of manufacturing which says that you make things in very large manufacturing plants. And after you have made things in the very large manufacturing plants, you then ship them by car or truck or boat or whatever to the place where they're actually used. Now, as we look forward into the future, it looks as though we will have a model of manufacturing which is much more distributed. In other words, we push the manufacturing down to the neighborhood level, down to the household level, where you can have a device which would manufacture products for you, and that this device would make things that you wanted. And furthermore, one of the things that this device could make, it would presumably be a boxy device that would sit on your kitchen table and be a kitchen appliance. One of the things that this device could make, it would have a menu of things you could make, would be another box. As a consequence, you can hand this box to your neighbor, and if it has a fixed list of things that it can manufacture, which are good and useful things generally recognized as safe, then this box could readily be made available to a fairly large population, providing a great abundance of those things which the box could make, which would presumably include food and solar cells and other basic things that would be useful. So I think as we see a shift from centralized manufacturing to a more distributed model of manufacturing, it will become clearer that we can have an availability and an abundance which is available to a larger number of people.
Can I also say that our existing systems are mostly about 99% inefficient, and by re-engineering them along the lines of the stuff in the book Natural Capitalism by Amory and Hunter Lovins and Paul Hawken, we could do this without all the dangers of these new technologies.
Yes.
How do we deal with the potential threat that a robot thinks certain entities do not exist and therefore are ignorable?
In fact, I worry about robots going getting strange beliefs by accident. And for a set of tame robots that in fact operate an industry that supports us, who are supposed to think a certain way and occasionally may fail to think so, I suggest there should be a policing system of the robots among themselves. Basically, fully automated companies act against companies that act illegally. And so I think it's certainly possible for machines to go crazy, just like people. And then you have police.
Well, people tell people too.
Black hat.
Will spiritual robots replace cyborgs in 2100?
It's just a question of how much biology there is in the in our descendants, and I think, in fact, biotechnologies or even new ones originated from existing organisms will become just one technology among many, and it'll be a technical question as to what you want to be implemented in.
Well, I think everything we've been talking about is derivative of humanity, and I think humanity will exist in 2100, but it will be, hopefully, if we can avoid the dangers which Bill Joy eloquently brings up, and which I think is a very serious challenge. I don't think relinquishment at a broad scale is the right approach, although relinquishment of very well identified dangers is a good option. But if we can navigate our way through the 21st century, and the story of the 21st century hasn't been written yet, we will end up with humanity in 2100, which will be a much richer, and I mean that in the more profound way, society with far greater capabilities, enriching our ability to experience life in all of its diversity. Thanks.
I want to say that I think that we could go on forever. What is clear is that we cannot see very far into the future. As I think it was Einstein, or maybe it was Bohr, said, prediction is hard, especially of the future. So at that, I think we'll close. And I